On his second voyage to the New World, Christopher Columbus brought sugarcane to the Caribbean island of Hispaniola. Sugar is now the biggest industry in the Dominican Republic, which shares the island with its impoverished neighbor, Haiti. Early this century, an American company began importing Haitian field hands to work its Dominican sugar holdings. Ever since, the back-wrenching task of cutting cane in the Dominican Republic has belonged to the migrant Haitians and their descendants. The Haitian cane cutters live in hundreds of rural ghettos known as batés. The living conditions of these permanent labor camps are considered to be among the worst in the hemisphere. Recently, reports by human rights groups denouncing treatment of the cane cutters prompted the United States to review trade relations with the Dominican Republic. The U.S. concluded that workers' conditions are improving and decided not to impose economic sanctions, thus preserving the Dominican Republic's broad duty-free access to U.S. markets. But, as producers Sandy Tolan and Alan Wiseman found, in much of the country, little has changed. Here is their report.
It's late afternoon. An old Haitian man in a sleeveless red t-shirt and stained cotton pants rests against a railroad embankment. Behind him, narrow-gauge tracks materialize and then vanish into a vast green carpet of undulating sugarcane. Several of his companions lead ox carts loaded with cane to a droning machine. A mechanized claw grabs bunches the size of small haystacks and dumps them into boxcars. Dozens of other men, their bare chests black and shiny with sweat, move slowly through the fields. Bending over, they grasp clumps of upright stalks with one hand. Their machetes slash downward.
This is going to be all my life, cutting cane. If I could do something else, I don't know. I can't even imagine what. When you live here, this is all you know, cutting cane. Even if you're born here, if you have skin as dark as I do, you are Haitian. You cut cane.
The Haitians live in rural ghettos called batés. Originally, these were seasonal work camps for the six-month sugar harvest. But many who gather for church services at this state-owned company baté in the province of Barahona have been here for decades without returning home. Even more were born here and have never been to Haiti. Legally, they are Dominican citizens, but the color of their skin and their Creole accents brand them as Haitians. That means they've been assigned the life of a cane cutter. Each year, at the height of the harvest, more arrive. The newcomers often don't earn enough to ever leave these little Haitis that dot the Dominican countryside. Their new home is a place that has no name, just a number.
It's an anachronism, eh? It's a throwback.
Leon Delaney, a Canadian Catholic brother, lives at Baté 5.
It's strange. It makes one think that really our roots, our history, is very strong. That these kind of practices can keep going through history for such a long time after slavery was supposedly abolished. But then it becomes part of the psyche, and that is a lot harder to take away.
This baté is a village of squat, tiny houses made of thatch or crumbling bricks and long concrete dwellings, rows of single rooms for newly arrived migrants. About 1,500 people live here. There are no paved roads, no plumbing, not even outhouses. Black pools of open sewage surround the buildings. Outside a concrete row house, a young woman uses a plastic pail to bathe her baby daughter. In the doorway, holding their three-year-old son, is her husband, a barefoot, wiry man in cut-off pants, who's just returned from the cane.
No, pas moi, Johnny. Johnny Jean.
Tata. Tata Pierre.
My name is Johnny Jean. I live here in Baté number 5.
My name is Tata Pierre.
We live here with our children, Jonira and Fernijan.
The 8-by-10-foot room contains two foam pads. A bare mattress spring serves as a shelf for a rolled-up wad of clothes, some tin plates, and two forks. In the corner stands a machete and a plastic gallon jug.
I should like to have a couple of chairs if people come to visit, to have some place to sit. There is no table to eat. Really, we are in poor conditions.
We have to sleep on the floor. I don't think that is natural. It's not good.
Any kind of animal can bite us, mice or rats. Then there are spiders. That is no good for us.
I don't feel well. I don't feel at home. I see that the company takes away most of what my husband makes. I can't buy the things I need to make the food. It's hard at times. I see my children go through a whole day without me able to give them anything to eat, and that hurts me.
Breakfast is a gallon of water and a hunk of sugarcane to chew. The noon meal is usually a cup of rice. About every week or two, they can afford a chicken. There is no supper.
I don't know why they treat us this way. When I ask people around here, they say that's the way the company does things, and that's it. If there were ever a bus passing by, I'd get on it. And if I ever get home to Haiti, I'll lie down in my bed, go to sleep, and never live there. But right now, I'm just stuck in this situation.
Of course, it's a hard job, the job of cutting the cane, absolutely.
José de Jesús Ovalle is the assistant commercial manager of the SEA, the state-run Dominican Sugar Council that owns about 3/4 of the country's sugar mills. Ovalle is in charge of exporting several hundred thousand tons of sugar to the U.S. every year.
You can go yourself to one of our fields and talk to the people who come here. They feel happy with what they do. There are isolated cases where might have been some bad treatment or something has happened, but the overall situation is fair.
Conditions of the cane cutters have often been denounced by human rights groups like the U.S.-based America's Watch. This spring, the Dominican government sent industrialist Manuel Tavares to Washington to respond to the most recent charges.
Just about all countries in the world import labor to do the jobs that the locals don't want to do, the United States included. And these workers typically live under worse conditions than the locals. And this is a fact of life. The Haitian cutters come here because they cannot get a job at home. This is their country of opportunity. This is paradise for them.
They've been told beautiful stories about the life here.
Brother Leon Delaney.
That we live in golden streets and that it's plentiful here. And when they come, they find that that is not the case at all. It's hard work. They get robbed in the weigh scales. They get robbed in the prices. Everybody uses you, exploits you in any way they can.
At the scales down the road from Bate 5, a cane cutter has brought in a load, 3,500 pounds. The cane looks like giant pickup sticks, hoisted by chains from the ox-drawn cart to a waiting rail car. The state-owned company pays $1.30 per ton if the cutter can wait 2 weeks for his pay. Nobody can, so an agent at the scale cashes his voucher, charging him 10%. For nearly 2 tons of cane, a day's work, the cutter gets $2.10. He leaves, angry. The cutters say the scales are rigged, but the men who run them aren't doing much better.
I start here at the pay scale at 6 in the morning. I work here all day, my head bent. Sometimes I am here until 11 or 12 at night. I earn $3.50 a day. We wake up working. All day we pull the chains and not even have gloves. Yeah, not even any gloves. Listen good. The problem of us Haitians is that this is not paying enough to eat. And if you try to get away, the police run you up.
and bring you back here to cut the cane.
In an economic sense, you can't speak of slavery because they pay them for the work. However, if a slave owner paid, I think it was the equivalent of about $100 in those days for a slave, then he would try to take care of his investment. Here, I think it's $21 they pay for a Haitian today per head at the border here. So if you can replace a worker for about $21 today, then you don't have to treat him that well. And if he dies on you, it's not that big of a loss for you.
For years, Haitians have been rounded up and forced to work the cane fields. The Dominican government and the U.S. Trade Representative's Office say things have improved, but human rights groups claim that, especially during critical harvest months, the roundups continue. Brother Leon explains.
See, there are these buscones, recruiters, who go from here to Haiti. They give them over at the border, and usually they set up what they call these pens, holding pens, where they keep these people. What happens is they're just bunched up, and then they're shipped off as cattle, like you would round up cattle, see, and then just ship them off.
Ramon Martinez, president of the Dominican Human Rights Commission, has heard the stories of the alleged holding pens. He drives west through the cane fields toward the border town of Jimaní to investigate.
No one wants to talk about it. The transporting and secret selling of Haitian workers is the work of retired military officers in state sugar cancel vehicles with military protection. Retired officials do the recruitment at night. Everybody sees it is happening, but nobody wants to know.
Nadie le gusta hablar de ese asunto.
¿Qué pasó?
Just 300 yards from the Dominican Customs House, Martinez finds what appears to be the place where Haitian workers are secretly processed. In a clearing surrounded by a grove of mesquite trees stand a metal desk and chair. It's still hours before nightfall, but already a few Haitian men wait silently on a nearby log. Carrying a camera, Martinez approaches the Haitians.
We are Ken Carus. We're here to work for the company.
Hey, why are you taking pictures here?
Now, four other men have appeared. Their leader is a stocky Dominican wearing Ray-Bans and black boots. He has a .38 revolver stuffed into the pocket of his khaki pants. As Martinez turns toward him, the Haitians slip away.
¿Quién es usted? Yo le repito, yo le puedo identificar quién soy yo. Y me identifico y le digo
exactamente. ¿Y quién lo autorizó también a entrar aquí a retratar?
Pero que yo no puedo hablar con desconocido. ¿Quién es usted para yo responder?
Why can I take pictures? Who are you to say I can't?
I work here. Who are you?
I am Dr. Ramón Martínez Puerto Real.
That's mean nothing to me. Who authorized your entrance?
What is this place? You work for who?
Ustedes no han consultado conmigo si yo tengo.
Pero que no sabemos quién es usted porque le hemos preguntado 15 veces.
Yo soy empleado, hermano, espérese.
You're recording.
Well, that's because we don't know who you are. We have asked you 15 times who you are.
I'm an employee of the State Sugar Council. I work with the SEA. Talk to me with respect.
Martinez pulls out his Human Rights Commission credentials. The Sugar Council employee, eyeing the microphones and camera, changes his story.
I'm not authorized to say anything. Actually, I don't work for the Sugar Council. I'm a chicken farmer, and I came because I have some chickens around here.
At the edge of the mesquite grove, Martinez makes a discovery, a hole in the ground filled with hypodermic needles and empty vaccine bottles.
You saw that?
What is this?
I don't know what the hell it is.
It's a bunch of, this is a Becton Dickinson and Company sterile and precision glide needle. It's for... This is where they give them immunizations. It's right here.
It's to cure the chickens.
This is for human beings. Are you saying, sir, that the chickens and roosters here are being given tetanus shots?
It's for the cockfights. It's for the roosters.
He says it's for fighting cocks. That's what he says.
At a restaurant in Jimani, Ramon Martinez finds the local public health supervisor, who confirms that the tetanus vaccine is for human beings, not for chickens. There's a special medical team belonging to the state sugar council, he says. The medics immunize arriving Haitian workers against infection from machete wounds and make sure they are strong enough to work. The Haitians fit to work are loaded onto buses bound for the state-run sugar plantations. Some, driven by hunger, have come willingly, but others are astonished suddenly to find themselves in a stark, windy Baté, surrounded by a sea of cane and armed guards. This is Baté 8. These workers just got off the bus.
They told me that the bus was going to the capital, but it came here to Baté 8.
I'm a carpenter, a mechanic, and a mason. I didn't come here to do this work at all.
At
the border, they give us this paper. I don't know what it means. I don't know how to read.
One of the men holds up a contract. There are two signatures, one for the worker and one for the state sugar council representative. The handwriting is identical. One side of the contract is in Spanish. The other is a garbled mixture of French and Haitian Creole. It says that the worker will serve wherever he is assigned, and that he promises not to leave without the company's consent.
I didn't sign anything. I didn't know what it is all about. The only thing that interests me is to make enough money to get back to my country.
At the edge of the group stands a skinny 14-year-old Haitian boy with sunken eyes. He is shirtless and shoeless and holds a fishing line wrapped around a stick.
Lulu Pierre.
My name is Lulu Pierre. I am from Wanamet. My mother and father and three brothers are there in Wanamet, and they don't know where I am now. I went to the border. I was helping people who were bringing things like bouillon cubes and cigarettes into Haiti. While I was there, this army officer grabbed me. I started to run, but he was armed. They put me in a red Daihatsu truck and took me to Yemeni. There were 25 of us in the truck. I was the youngest. They sold us to this place here. They gave us a machete and a plastic jug for water. We had to bring in the first cart full of cane before we could eat anything. When I went to the cane field, on the first swipe, I cut my foot. With the second, I cut my hand. I said, I can't do this work. So I resolved not to do it and see what God is going to do with me. Today is Sunday. I haven't had anything to eat since Friday. They gave me a little rice then. I don't like this place. I really don't know how to cut cane. I have to go home.
But for now, Lulu's home is an airless concrete stall containing an iron bed, a sleeping pad, a machete, and nothing else. Stifling afternoon heat beats through the roof.
I feel like an animal in some faraway place that is not very hospitable. I feel pretty bad when I'm sleeping, thinking about, oh, I sleep well at home, at ease. I feel like an animal in the wilderness.
Dominican President Joaquin Balaguer, facing increased international pressure, decreed that elderly cane cutters and children under 16 who work the fields should be sent back to Haiti.
What we're seeing is a good faith effort to try to improve things.
Paul Taylor is the United States ambassador in the Dominican Republic.
I think one does also have to recognize that President Balaguer and other Dominicans have something when they say that the conditions of all workers in the sugar industry, for example, are less than we would like them to be.
Yet during the current sugar harvest, the practice of abduction of boys like Lulu Pierre and forced labor continued. So did the use of muddled, falsified contracts for people who can't read. Ambassador Taylor says it's not the U.S.'s role to monitor all that.
We are neither advocates nor are we involved in the internal workings of this country. We will continue to rely on lots of observers to provide assessments and to provide us input, but we are not able nor interested in going around looking at individual contracts, or can we look at every allegation. It's beyond our ability and beyond, frankly, our interest.
The U.S. decision to continue granting preferential trade status to the Dominican Republic may ultimately have had little to do with the rights of cane cutters. Hundreds of U.S.-owned companies have their factories here in order to take advantage of cheap Dominican labor. Any American sanctions would affect not just the sugar industry, but also U.S. businesses operating here.
To lose all this preference will be a great catastrophe.
At the American Chamber of Commerce of the Dominican Republic, Doris Paul, Director of Public Relations, describes what could have happened if the U.S. had rescinded preferential trade status.
We would lose the markets. Practically, it would be the end of the Dominican Republic. This excess of everything depends on the economics, and the economics is bad. The whole country is going bad.
Inside a vast warehouse at the Dominican port of Haina, bulldozers push a mountain of sugar onto a conveyor headed to a ship bound for the U.S.
It's a very fine system, refined, fine-tuned. You see, it's done little by little. The guy who's on top hardly ever sees the one who's on the bottom, doesn't know what's happening. The guy who's on top, really, you might say, is the fellow on the exchange in New York, who's making millions on a sugar transaction. He never sees a bate, what a 1,000 braceros make in a year, he makes in a day or in an hour. The guy who's right at the bottom, say this guy who's come from Haiti and who's sleeping outside on some leaves, he's right at the bottom. But the guy who's just on top of him, who's telling him he can't leave the bate, now, he's awful poor. The only thing he has is this little job. Now, the guy who's on top of him, it's a little step again, and a little step, and a little step. It goes by many steps. And when you look at the whole process from the top to the bottom, you say, my God, what has happened here? But actually, it's been done by a little step by step.
With Alan Wiseman, this is Sandy Tolan reporting.